much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
Mm-hmm. Amir, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Researchers say the explosion of plastic production in the past 70 years from 2 million tons to 380 million tons a year had given microbes time to evolve to deal with plastic. We're prepared an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled Study Find Bugs Across the Globe Are Evolving to Eat Plastic. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to the study, microbes in oceans and soils across the globe are evolving to eat plastic. The research scanned more than 200 million genes found in DNA. Samples taken from the environment and found 30,000 different enzymes that could degrade 10 different types of plastic. The study is the first large-scale global assessment of the plastic degrading potential of bacteria and found that one in four of the organisms analyzed carried a suitable enzyme. The researchers found that the number and type of enzymes they discovered matched the amount and type of plastic pollution in different locations. The scientists said the results provided evidence of a measurable effect of plastic pollution on the global microbial ecology. Millions of tons of plastic are dumped in the environment every year, and the pollution now pervades the planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest oceans. Reducing the amount of plastic used is vital, as is the proper collection and treatment of waste. But many plastics are currently hard to degrade and recycle, using enzymes to rapidly break down plastics into their building blocks, would enable new products to be made from old ones, cutting the need for virgin plastic production. The new research provides many new enzymes to be investigated and adapted for industrial use. Professor Alexei Selezniak at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden said, "We've found multiple lines of evidence supporting the fact that the global microbiome's plastic degrading potential correlates strongly with measurements of environmental plastic pollution, a significant demonstration of how the environment is responding to the pressures we are placing on it." Jan Zrimek, also at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, said, "We did not expect to find such a large number of enzymes across so many different microbes and environmental habitats. This is a surprising discovery that really illustrates the scale of the issue. The explosion of plastic production in the past 70 years, from 2 million tons to 380 million tons a year, had given microbes time to evolve to deal with plastic," the researchers said. The study, published in the journal Microbial Ecology, started by compiling a dataset of 95 microbial enzymes already known to degrade plastic, often found in bacteria in rubbish dumps and similar places rife with plastic. The team then looked for similar enzymes in environmental DNA samples taken by other researchers from 236 different locations across the world. Importantly, the researchers ruled out potential false positives by comparing the enzymes initially identified with enzymes from the human gut, which is not known to have any plastic-degrading enzymes. About 12,000 of the new enzymes were found in the ocean samples, taken at 67 locations and at 3 different depths. The results showed consistently higher levels of degrading enzymes at deeper levels in the ocean, matching the higher levels of plastic pollution known to exist at lower depths. The soil samples were taken from 169 locations in 38 countries and 11 different habitats and contained 18,000 plastic-degrading enzymes. Soils are known to contain more plastics with phthalate additives that the oceans, and the researchers found more enzymes that attack these chemicals in the land samples. The scientists said nearly 60% of the new enzymes did not fit into any known enzyme classes, suggesting these molecules degrade plastics in ways that were previously unknown. Professor Selezniak said the next step would be to test the most promising enzyme candidates in the laboratory to closely investigate their properties and the rate of plastic degradation that they can achieve. He added, "From there, you could engineer microbial communities with targeted degrading functions for specific polymer types." The first bug that eats plastic was discovered in a Japanese waste dump in 2016. Scientists then tweaked it in 2018 to try to learn more about it and how it evolved, but inadvertently they created an enzyme that was even better at breaking down plastic bottles. Further tweaks in 2020 increased the speed of degradation sixfold. Another mutant enzyme was created in 2020 by the company Carbios that breaks down plastic bottles for recycling in hours. German scientists have also discovered the bacterium that feeds on the toxic plastic polyurethane, which is usually dumped in landfills. Recently, scientists revealed that levels of microplastics known to be eaten by people via their food cause damage to human cells in the laboratory. The study has found microplastics cause damage to human cells in the laboratory at the levels known to be eaten by people via their food. The harm included cell death and allergic reactions, and the research is the first to show this happens at levels relevant to human exposure. However, the health impact of the human body is uncertain because it is not known how long microplastics remain in the human body before being excreted. As we mentioned, microplastic pollution has contaminated the entire planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest of oceans. People were already known to consume the tiny particles via their food and water, as well as breathing them in. The research analysed 17 previous studies which looked at the toxicological impacts of microplastics on human cell lines. The scientists compared the level of microplastics at which damage was caused to the cells with the levels consumed by people through contaminated drinking water, contaminated seafood and table salt. They found specific types of harm, cell death, allergic response and damage to cell walls, were caused by the levels of microplastics that people ingest. Evangelos Donopoulos, the Hull York Medical School in United Kingdom, and who led the research published in the Journal of Hazardous Materials, said, "Harmful effects on cells are in many cases the initiating event for health effects." He added, "We should be concerned. Right now, there isn't really a way to protect ourselves." He said future research could make it possible to identify the most contaminated foods and avoid them, but the ultimate solution was to stop the loss of plastic waste. Once the plastic is in the environment, we can't really get it out. Research on the health impact of microplastics is ramping up quickly. Evangelos Donopoulos of the Hull York Medical School said, "It is exploding, and for good reason. We are exposed to these particles every day. We're eating them, we're inhaling them, and we don't really know how they react with our bodies once they're in." The research also showed irregularly shaped microplastics cause more cell deaths than spherical ones. This is important for future studies, as many microplastics bought for use in laboratory experiments are spherical and therefore may not be representative of the particles humans ingest. Microplastics researcher Steve Allen said, "This work helps inform where research should be looking to find real-world effects. It was interesting that shape was so important to toxicity, as it confirms what many plastic pollution researchers believed would be happening, that pristine spheres used in laboratory experiments may not be showing the real-world effects." Donopoulos said the next step for researchers was to look at studies of microplastic harm in laboratory animals. Experiments on human subjects would not be ethical. In March, a study showed tiny plastic particles in the lungs of pregnant rats pass rapidly into their hearts, brains and other organs, and even their fetuses. In December, microplastics were revealed in the placentas of unborn babies, which the researchers said was a matter of great concern. In October, scientists showed that babies fed formula milk in plastic bottles were swallowing millions of plastic particles a day.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea. Bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now. And they have to know this is, it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat. We had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal. Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbas. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbas.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the U.S., have taken. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then if it wasn't willing to face the music?
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January, when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
They learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue since the Trump administration continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea, or South Korea, is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea all forces
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity. The United States, Britain, Europe, and Canada moved to block certain Russian banks' access to the SWIFT international payment system as part of more sanctions against Moscow as it continues its military operation against Ukraine.
We are resolved to continue imposing massive costs on Russia, costs that will further isolate Russia from the international financial system and our economies.
The measures, which will also include restrictions on the Russian central bank's international reserves, will be implemented in the coming days.
We will paralyze the assets of Russia's central bank. This will freeze its transactions, and it made it impossible for the central bank to liquidate assets.
Von der Leyen said removing Russia from SWIFT will paralyze Russia's international trade and effectively stop its imports and exports. Earlier, Berlin announced it has agreed to limit Moscow's access to SWIFT as well. The SWIFT system is a Belgian cooperative that offers many services in assisting businesses and individuals to complete seamless and accurate business transactions. Western countries have joined the chorus as well. The US says Western nations will also impose restrictive measures on the Russian central bank to prevent it from deploying its international reserves in ways that undermine the impact of sanctions. But how much damage will these sanctions have on the fragile global economy? The sanctions add to the economic impact of this crisis and will transmit primarily through energy prices as well as grain prices. Russia and Ukraine supply crops to a long list of countries around the world, including large volumes to buyers in the Middle East and Africa. Sanctions will also add to a growing concern of inflation. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of the EU's oil imports and 40% of the EU's gas imports. The world energy market and commodities have been affected and will continue to witness price surges, especially when it comes to oil. On Thursday, oil prices briefly topped $100 for the first time since 2014. The US and several of its allies, including the European Union and the United Kingdom, have vowed to impose further restrictions on Moscow as punishment. In total, the sanctions will keep approximately $1 trillion in Russian banking assets from flowing through the markets of the US and its partners' financial systems. The sanctions also limit tech exports to Russia and squeeze the country's tech industry. Those sanctions are the main foreign policy tool of Americans. The effectiveness of this tactic is debated. The sanctions already announced are significant in size and scope, but the long-time American reliance on sanctions has left the US with few other options if Russia does not respond. Experts say Russia's sanctions are a big deal, but it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy.
They think they can destroy Russia and China by cutting them off. They cannot. It's a false dream. And it, unfortunately, if they continue, it probably will lead to war, perhaps nuclear war, and the annihilation of the human race.
Russian officials dismiss Western sanctions as ineffective. Russia's GDP has grown yet at a slow rate since the West imposed financial sanctions on Russia in 2014. The country's officials also point to low inflation, the minimal budget deficit, a public debt of only 18% of GDP at the end of 2020, steady current account surpluses, and international currency reserves of $596 billion at the end of 2020. Russians have got used to sanctions and therefore adapted their economy to them.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865. But the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor. We can feed off of their work. We can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African-American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Former Senator David Perdue knows how to crash a party. When he announced that he would seek the 2022 Republican nomination for governor in Georgia, challenging the incumbent Brian Kemp, he did more than enter a primary race. The article you're about to hear has been written by Matthew Continetti, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the book The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. The article has been published by the New York Times, and it's titled, Will Trump Ruin a Red Wave in 2022? Former Senator David Perdue knows how to crash a party. When he announced that he would seek the 2022 Republican nomination for governor of Georgia, challenging the incumbent Brian Kemp, he did more than enter a primary race. He illustrated the dangers facing the GOP in the coming year. Georgia Republicans are divided over former President Donald Trump and torn between mainstream credibility and the conspiratorial fringe. David Perdue, an ally of Donald Trump, has made these divisions worse. The beneficiary, the Democrat Stacey Abrams. Republicans worry about internal strife and outlandish messages that turn off swing voters because everything else is going their way. The party did well in last month's elections. President Biden's low approval ratings endanger Democrats in Congress, where Republicans must net only 5 seats in the House of Representatives and 1 in the Senate to seize control. Republican strength at the state level gives the party an advantage in drawing new maps of congressional districts, which will amplify their slim lead in the 538 estimate of the congressional generic ballot. Yet history shows how expectations can be thwarted. Republicans have experienced hopeful times before, only to have the moment pass. They believed that disapproval of President Bill Clinton's conduct would expand their majorities in 1998. They ended up losing 5 House seats. They believed that Donald Trump would rally the base to support 2 incumbent senators during runoffs in Georgia last January. But they lost both seats and control of the Senate. Time and again, the biggest obstacle to a red wave hasn't been the Democratic Party. In fact, it's been the Republican Party. Republican victories in the midterms next year are far from preordained. Glenn Youngkin's win in Virginia may be much harder to replicate elsewhere than it looked on election night. Republican leaders continue to fear Donald Trump and his supporters, and they are divided over candidate selection, message and agenda. The result is a unique combination of external strength and internal rot. An enthusiastic and combative Republican Party that, despite its best efforts, may soon acquire power it has done nothing to deserve. it will be hard for the party to appeal to the suburban independents who decide elections. Though, Mr. Yonkin's success suggests a path. He is the first Republican elected governor of Virginia in over a decade because of his emphasis on kitchen table issues like rising prices and school closures. He ignored immigration, encouraged vaccination while opposing government mandates and stayed clear of Donald Trump during the general election. He focused on parental involvement in education and planted himself firmly in the center-right of the political mainstream. When asked about a Trump rally where the Pledge of Allegiance was recited to a flag supposedly connected to the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol, Mr. Yonkin called it weird and wrong. One Republican senator joked in private that Greg Yonkin had figured out how to hold Donald Trump's hand under the table and in the dark. Other candidates won't be as skilled or as lucky as Glenn Youngkin. Republicans lost winnable Senate seats in 2010 and 2012 because of flawed nominees like Sharon Angle in Nevada, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, Todd Akin in Missouri, and Richard Murdoch in Indiana. Past may be prologue if Republicans nominate Donald Trump allies whose record or rhetoric are questionable and extreme. Last month, one Trump-endorsed candidate for Senate, Sean Parnell of Pennsylvania, suspended his campaign after he lost a custody battle against his estranged wife. The Trump-endorsees, Kelly Shibaka of Alaska and Herschel Walker of Georgia, are untested on the campaign trail. In races where Donald Trump hasn't yet endorsed, Blake Masters of Arizona, Eric Greitens of Missouri, and J.D. Vance of Ohio may secure the MAGA base by forfeiting viability in the general election. Donald Trump remains the central figure in the GOP. Party elites try to ignore him as he spends many days fighting Republicans rather than Democrats and plotting his revenge against the 10 Republican House members who voted for his second impeachment. The 7 Republican senators who voted to convict him and the 13 House Republicans who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Donald Trump targets his enemies with primary challenges, calls for audits and decertification of the 2020 presidential results, and howls at Mitch McConnell for not being tough. His imitators within the party are a font of endless infighting and controversy, and they undermine the authority of the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy. Mr. Trump would have it no other way. The former president was content to keep a distance in this year's races for governor. He won't be so quiet next year, especially if he concludes that a successful midterm election is a key step to his restoration to power in 2024. A more visible and vocal Donald Trump has the potential to help Republicans in solid red states, but doom them in purple or blue states. Yet control of the Senate hinges on the results in Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire, states that Donald Trump lost in 2020. Glenn Youngkin showed that a positive message attuned to a middle-class priorities repels Democratic attacks. If Republicans campaign on a unified message that applies conservative principles to inflation, the border, crime, education and healthcare, they might be able to avoid being tagged as the party of extremism, conspiracy theories, and loyalty to Donald Trump. Their problem is that they have no such message. Mitch McConnell has reportedly told Senate Republicans that they won't release an agenda before the midterm elections. He's worried that specific proposals are nothing but fodder for Democratic attacks. What should worry him more are rudderless Republican candidates who allow their Democratic opponents to define them negatively, and then, if they still win, take office in January of 2023 with no idea what to do. In an ideal world, more Republicans would think seriously about how best to provide individuals and families with the resources necessary to flourish in today's America. They would spend less time attacking one another and more time offering constructive approaches to inflation and dangerous streets. They would experiment with a ranked choice primary system that played a role in Glenn Youngkin's nomination in Virginia and in the law and order Democrat Eric Adams' win in New York City's mayoral race. Interested Republicans would declare today that Donald Trump won't deter them from seeking the presidency, reminding him that renomination is not guaranteed. But that's not the world that we live in. Republicans appear either unwilling or unable to treat the former president as a figure from the past, whose behavior has done the party more harm than good. They take false comfort in the idea that midterm elections are thermostatic, the inevitable repudiation, climatic in nature, of the governing party. They assume that they will win next year without doing anything of significance. And they may be right.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator Ofcom asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel, foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts, and this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move toward peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia's allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories. Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefronts. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam, that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam.